And by flux compactifications, what will be meant here is some any back-reacted background of string theory which has non-trivial flux configurations or brains, as I said, is back-reacted and thus satisfies all the equations of motion and everything. All right, so the first thing which struck me about this subject when I was sort of trying to learn it and understand what's happening a few years ago was the sort of discrepancy or the dichotomy between the compact and non-compact cases. So from one side, there was a great zoo of all sorts of non-compact examples and a great scarcity of anything which was compact. And that's, well, that's a feature which probably will stay forever for good reasons. But OK, so one of the motivations was try to understand it in some kind of reasonable sense. And OK, I can say that at least one area in which there was some progress achieved is in sort of ranging this zoo of non-compact stuff. At least we can classify and tabulate and understand what these things are. But OK, let me start from the beginning. And the beginning is just type two supergravity variations. And so I'm just writing 10-dimensional supersymmetry. So the gravitino variation is okay, and there is also a combination of gravitino and dilatino, which also takes a particularly simple form, which is just simply trace of the gravitino minus dilatino, from which apparently all the Ramon-Ramon part simply drops out. Okay, so probably many of you are used to seeing a little messier supergravity equations. So what I'm using here is something which is called democratic formalism, which has a huge number of advantages. I mean, one of which is simply that you can almost memorize it. Second, that it's the same for type 2a and type 2b. Okay, modulo, I will not be writing this down, so there are some projectors. What is meant here by epsilon is a pair of Majorana spinners. And so F2n is dc of 2n minus 1 minus h wedge c 2n minus 3. And the notation, I don't know why it is such, that n is chosen to be from 0 to 5 for type 2a. And for type 2b, it's chosen to be half integer. 9 over 2. OK, so this thing has the same form for type 2a and type 2b strings. Moreover, it's naturally appearing in the string frame. And OK, among other advantages is the simple form in which h ag appears and the fact that there exists a linear combination of dilatino and gravitino from where Ramon-Ramon just drops out altogether. I mean, a little more probably conceptually, there is also another, I mean, it's not going to play too big of a role here, but we know it is a correct sort of stringy thing to do, is that this Ramon-Ramon field strength, F2n, which again all appear with the same powers of dilaton and everything in a very systematic way, that these are all alternating field strengths, either even or odd. But they are all there, and so some self-duality has to be imposed there, which is written in this form, where lambda is an operation, so which acting on any P form, sends it to more or less itself with just a possible plus or minus 1. Okay. So if, for example, we have the odd series, 1 form, 3 form, 4, 5 form, and so on, this lambda on it will make it F1 minus F3 plus F5, and so on. Okay? So this is our starting point. It's sufficiently simple. And the idea is not to make any particular ansatz about what we are going to do, other than simply that we want to have four-dimensional Poincaré symmetry preserved, okay? Which means, okay, I will not be mentioning at all ADS here, but that the possible backgrounds, four-dimensional parts, are either Minkowski or Poincaré, okay, or ADS. So preserving four-dimensional Poincaré means we have to assume certain things about the fluxes. So in particular, H will be fully internal, and all Ramon-Ramon fluxes, right, will have to be of the form. Written here, but will be of the form F plus, you know, volume 4 wedge F tilde.
Something.
Which means it with such an assumption of.
Which F is which? Where F on the right-hand side is in the internal space?
All right, so this F is 10-dimensional. Let me, yes, thank you. So these Fs, I will not want to put anything on top of them because these are the Fs with which I will be working from now on.
So they're just tangent.
Right. And actually, in order to have the right self-duality, the way I should be writing this would be like that. Okay?
So star is for the internal space?
Now this is, so anything 10-dimensional is explicitly marked. So here I have 10-dimensional star, here the star is 6-dimensional. So from now on, unless actually this would be the first sort of message which I will try to convey, that everything 10-dimensional, all equations of motion, tadpoles, Bianchis, everything, is going to be written purely in terms of 6-dimensional terms, okay? And the lift to the full string theory is automatically guaranteed, okay? So from now on, essentially, I'll be working only with 6-dimensional quantities, but I'll be solving the full string theory again. Provided here is my decomposition for the Fs and for the metric, I just simply take this 6 square. So the F which appears here is simply now, because of the split in 4 plus 6, the self-duality is removed. So F equals F0 plus F2 plus F4 plus F6 for 2b and equals F1 plus F3 plus F5 for 2a. Okay? Is it? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I guess my hands wrote it correctly. A and then B. Okay. All right. So I have to do the decomposition in the fermions in the similar way. I mean, which will be chiral for type 2B and non-chiral for type 2A. Well, do we? So where four-dimensional spinners are just Majorana conjugates, 1 plus xi minus times eta minus 1, and similarly for eta 2. So this will be non-well, okay, just write it. Plus minus 2 plus xi minus times eta 2 plus. So this will be for 2a and for 2b. Just write it as xi plus times I plus xi minus times I. And the internal spinners, I plus, are just related by conjugation. Okay? So I'm not taking any normalization here so far. Anything. Okay? So we know there is this law that solution of equations of motion is or full string theory is guaranteed provided we solve for supersymmetry and all flux equations of motion and Bianchi identities. Okay, so a priori we don't have to check the Einstein equation. So let me write the flux equations of motion and Bianchi identities. So this will appear to be in the following form. Due to, I mean, this formulation, there is a sort of pseudo-action. Because of self-duality, the action has not been written. Yes?
So here you're looking only at static background.
The only static, yeah. So the action has not...
Agree, Ruben, you can write an action.
Yeah, of course you can. Anyway, it hasn't been worked out, let's say.
It has been worked out.
All right. Anyway, here's then without any excuses, I'll just simply write the equations of motion.
You can write an action.
Dimitri Belov and I.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of it. All right, anyway, here is a simple-looking equation of motion for H field. This is all now internal, and again, you can understand that this guy sort of comes from a Chern-Simons coupling in 10 dimensions, which is sort of the form B wedge F N wedge lambda of F N minus 2. Okay, when you... sort of write it in six-dimensional terms, you see that there is a star sort of popping up here. So for H, there will be no five-brain configurations here. So DH is taken zero. And then I have Ramon equations of motion and Bianchi identities, which are even simpler looking. E to the 4A star F equals zero. And then B minus H F. So, okay, I write a delta, which a priori can also be zero for some f's, but this is just to indicate that, all right, I am expected to have some sources, okay? So, what we want to do at this point, write these equations in terms of sort of another set of variables, let's say, quote unquote, which will be easier to work with rather than just simply supersymmetry variations, okay? So the claim is that such a set of variables is essentially given by Fierzing. So let me just simply consider things like this, eta 1 tensor product with eta 2 plus minus. And we know that these things are nicely decomposed in terms of even and odd forms, right? So this is eta plus minus bigger gamma mk m1 eta 1 mk. So in particular, if I just happen to choose two simplest things possible, eta plus 1, 2 plus I could have taken, of course, some linear combination of etas here, but things would not have changed, okay? So if I choose these two things, I will now rewrite all my equations in terms of these two objects, okay? Before I go on, and in a moment I'll also write sort of in convenient ways what these objects really are, but for now they are just tensor products of my supersymmetry parameters, okay? I can just establish two formal properties of these two objects before I move on, okay? One is that both phi plus and phi minus have six annihilators each. I can write it down explicitly, so I am n eta plus 1. So this will be 0, where I is the complex structure associated with eta 1 or eta 2, respectively. And the other three of the annihilators will be acting from the right, and they are okay. So each has six annihilators. Moreover, just visually you can see. I mean, I have here plus minus, and here I have plus minus, except that here the sign changes. The three of these annihilators are in common. Okay.
What is the delta?
Delta, yeah. One. For m equals n and zero otherwise. All right. So the other property is that phi plus and phi minus have three annihilators in common. These will be very important properties. For now, they are just purely formal, and they just come out of by construction. Okay. So, okay, I have constructed my basic objects. Now I have to do just some work. And believe me, you can do this work. And what you get after having done it is a pair of differential equations, which are like this. Equals f plus and f2 equals f minus for 2a theory, and f1 equals for 2b theory. Okay, so the equations look identical up to choice of what phi is, and clearly f's are also either even or odd.
I really don't understand your presentation. You're taking the eta's were supersymmetry parameters. I think what you mean to say is that you could have written the Ramon fields as bispinners, because the capital phi's are encoding your Ramon field.
No, capital phi's are encoding my Neve-Schwarz sector.
Whoops.
You know, when I write Fierzing, right, you know that these guys will have...
I understand that a product of spinners can be written as a bunch of different...
So that's what I'm going to do in a moment.
The eta's were supersymmetry parameters?
Eta's were supersymmetry parameters. Internal part. I'll write in a moment what phi's are, okay?
Then let me reiterate Greg's question. What is the meaning of this equation, physical meaning of this?
All right, a priori I'm taking these equations, well, after having done the 4 plus 6 split, so I get two Gravitino equations, internal and external. I get one Di Latino equation. I am using one equation to plug into another. But essentially what I'm doing, I am projecting it to another set of variables. So roughly speaking, I'm taking supersymmetry variations, and I'm tensoring them with etas and doing some projections. Okay. So the result?
I'm also confused. So this equation seemed to be constraining etas, whereas those equations were constraining Ramon fields.
Why do you say that those equations a priori are constraining everything? They are constraining my supersymmetric background. So here what I'm saying is that Ramon-Ramon fields actually will be completely determined by Neve-Schwarz sector. So that never mind whatever flux configuration I choose, there is going to be some part of Neve-Schwarz sector which is going to be protected, which is not going to receive back reaction.
The capital phi's are written in terms of, are encoding the geometry, right?
Absolutely.
So the eta's were the covariantly constant spinners, or some kind of spinner.
Some covariantly constant with respect to some connection. Okay.
So the phi's are encoding the B fields and the G.
Not yet. You see, B is out for the moment.
E to the B.
But yes.
Okay. So the phi's are encoding the metric.
Right. Okay. Notice that because by this property of them being even or odd, I could have done something like this in any dimension. It would not be of much value because these two equations will not be, as I said, I'm projecting things. So the magic of six dimensions is that these two equations contain everything there is in supersymmetry. So if I try to do this in 10, for example, I would have to write extra equations, okay? But in six dimensions, one can show that this pair of equations contains everything there is about to know about supersymmetry. Moreover, it's not hard to see that actually the equations know a little even more. So notice that these phis are neither normalized, nor they contain some phases inside. Okay, I didn't say much about this eta's, so there are a priori some complex numbers inside. So there are phases. So if I decompose this equation into real and imaginary part, you see, this part is it's purely imaginary. So there is going to be the real part of this decomposition is also going to have zero, right? The imaginary part will look like b minus h e to the. Now I try to put the normalizations in imaginary phi 2 will be equal to 1 over 8 e to the 4a star lambda f. So if I act by lambda, this will be flipping a sign of h. And you can see that if you compare with this equation of motion, that it automatically follows from this equation. So in other words, f, the series of Ramon-Ramon fluxes, they are d plus h exact, and thus they are d plus h closed. Okay. So you get some kind of bonus from doing this work is that Ramon-Ramon equations of motion are automatic. Okay, if you are satisfying this pair of equations, Ramon-Ramon equations of motion simply follow. That is absolutely not true about the Bianchis. Okay. On the contrary, it has been shown further that if Ramon-Ramon Bianchi identities are satisfied, and if supersymmetry is satisfied, then for Minkowski spaces, also H equations of motion are automatically satisfied. Not the case for ADS. Okay? So essentially, if you are solving this, and you manage to solve Bianchi identities for Ramon-Ramon fields, you are pretty much there. Okay? And once more, the embedding into 10-dimensional string theory is guaranteed by construction. So one thing which you would be sort of worried about in the right now, you could say, okay, speaking of 10-dimensional string theory, we know the following thing, which there are tadpoles. In particular, one way of seeing them is you take 4-dimensional Einstein equation, and you trace it. And that's what gives you the tadpole. So living in 6 dimensions, how do you even see 4-dimensional tadpole? And the answer is not so difficult, that if I take the F Bianchi identity and I essentially complete it to a top form, so I'm writing something which is called the Mukai pairing, which essentially from alternating sums of forms just picks the top form, and in the second part of the of this product, there is a lambda sitting. Well, I'll just write the definition. So if I have a b, this is equal to a wedge lambda b top 4. Okay. So if I do this, indeed this has the number of degrees of freedom of a scalar. It's a top 4. Okay. And after some work, you can show that this guy is actually of definite sign. So essentially, it's a minus perfect square. Okay. In other words, you get something which you knew all along, that in order to consistently compactify, you need some kind of negative tension sources. Okay. Note that Bianchi identity itself, as I have written here, can be, I mean, so if I write B minus H F, this guy can have, I don't know, some numerous sources. In particular, some of them can be brains and some of them can be planes. So generically, if F is not a top form, so we have this lucky case in the so-called type B solution in type 2B theory, where the tadpole is a top form automatically. So in that case, all we have to do is just count the overall charge. Generically, there will be sort of smaller objects, and they have there are questions of orientations and things like that. But the claim is this, that you take all possible brains and planes, whatever, all possible sources, you project them into a top form, and the net charge is supposed to be that of an O-plane. Okay? So this is something which we have to bear in mind whenever we sort of try to talk about compactification, that whatever we do eventually is supposed to be compatible with some kind of involution. Okay? Now let me write down explicitly what these phis are, and then I'll go on trying to explain. Okay, so I could do the simplest thing possible. I mean, here there is a proportionality sign, so I'm ignoring all the normalizations. Okay, so let me just do the simplest possible thing, which is just assume that I have some, again, covariant with respect to some connection. Okay, so some spinner without zeros, which this situation goes under name of SU3 structure. And algebraically, it resembles, I mean, it is exactly the same as what we have in Calabi-Yau's, except that differential conditions are different. Okay? So if I was to compute my phi plus and phi minus in this situation, here is what I would get. So in the phi plus, I get, which is the sum, formal sum of even forms, I get an exponentiated fundamental form. So when this is closed, then I have a symplectic manifold. Generically, I don't. And here I have the familiar omega. Okay? So it's very easy to see that these guys have six annihilators each. So omega contracted with anything anti-holomorphic vanishes, and wedged with anything holomorphic vanishes. So these are the six annihilators in question. So this is, it's also easy to see that J itself is, would not be pure. One is pure, volume form is pure, but J is not. Okay? So e to the ij, on the contrary, is. So the way it works, I mean, okay, maybe I should write it, that e to the ij, you just think of it as a Taylor expansion, right? 1 minus ij minus 1 half j square, and so on. So the way you would construct the annihilators is sort of a creator acting on one, and annihilator one form down here, and then they mutually cancel, and so on. And you can also check that there are six of them. Moreover, three of them would be the same as for omega. Okay? All right. So I could have more exotic or, I don't know, more special situations. In particular, if I take just this situation and consider on top of it a possibility that I live on a six-dimensional manifold with a zero Euler number. So what it tells me is that there are necessarily vector. Actually, there is a bivector, but there is at least one vector without zeros by Hopf's theorem. So in other words, if I have some spinner without zeros, by Clifford acting by the vector, I create another spinner. Okay? And, okay, I mean, so Of course, Calabi-Yau's would be classical examples of this, but there are more. So example of this situation will be, let's say, K3 times T2. Another less trivial example would be a T2 vibration over K3. So it's not hard. Yes, Greg, Ali. So this guy has Betti numbers 1, 2, 23, 42. Where this is B1, B2, B3, B4. And you can check that the right alternating sum is 0. So this is not hard to calculate, and you can see that this is 1, 0, 20, this would be 44, and this is 42. And
K3 cross T2 has B1 equal 2.
Why the characters multiply?
Sorry.
How can B4 be different from B4?
Sorry?
Yeah, now it looks
clear. Okay. The reason I was confused is, how do you get it? You're not saying there's a topologically non-trivial T2 bundle over K3, right?
Why not? If I take a 6 manifold, which is a bundle.
Because K3 is simply connected, I'm confused.
So? It has
Classifying space for T2 bundles is going to be. Oh, maybe there's a two cell there.
No, there is.
Unit circle bundle over two sphere.
Yeah. No, you have plenty actually. I think. And I believe Catherine will be speaking a lot about this sort of things, and in particular this underlying SU2 structure. So this would be a case where I have SU2 structure rather than SU3. And this underlying SU2 structure is the reason why you can have, let's say, an equal 2 supersymmetry and not just an equal 1 in the background, in the heterotic backgrounds, which are obtained from such compactifications. Okay. So in this case, if I write the 1 forms, which are sort of conjugate via metric to the vectors with V and omega, then I would write things in this form, and then I have okay. So the reason actually I gave these examples is because on those it's very easy to visualize what omega and J would be and where these 1 forms are. Okay. So I could have something a little more general where I don't have this luxury of having Euler number equal 0, but I have some vectors which can have zeros somewhere. Okay. So if I allow for vectors to have some zeros, I could sort of, this goes normally under name of SU3 times SU3 on T plus T star, then I could have some sort of more general situation.
We have n equal 2 in 4 dimensions. Is that your working assumption?
Sorry?
Your working assumption is n equal 2 in 4 dimensions?
No.
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 That was the claim that in those examples, that's what we get.
No, I am saying, okay, so actually this is one of the reasonably weak points of the formalism is I can do more, these conditions which I wrote, they tell you a necessary condition for n equal 1 supersymmetry. So the way I would do n equal 2 in this formalism is find a completely different pair of compatible these objects which also satisfy such equation. And then n equal 3, n equal 4, whatever. So it just simply says that phi1, phi2, these kind of equations have more solutions than for one pair of phi1, phi2. Okay? But all I'm talking about, I have in mind solving at least one. So I just want to have a necessary condition in mind.
Right,
okay?
But the claim about this, say, non-trivial vibration was that it gives an equals 2, right? Or am I mistaken?
I'm saying that depending on the choice of the connection, maybe I shouldn't be giving Catherine's talk. So depending on your choice of the connection in this vibration, you could have, in heterotic compactifications on such manifolds, either n equal 1 or n equal 2.
When you say heterotic?
I was just talking about the structures. So in heterotic, you have something similar. You can have supersymmetry enhancement, okay?
Heterotic, you have less supersymmetry to start with, so what
might all right, so let me not talk about heterotic. I mean, I can tell you afterwards. I was just making a point about having more than one structure, okay?
But didn't you start with two coherently constant spinners?
I did, because this was my type 2. And this is also one more caveat, that in all this derivation, I can never take these spinners to be the same. So indeed, these equations would not apply to heterotic string. Explicitly, they do not apply. So the system is somehow degenerate if I take Ramon-Ramon fluxes to zero. This doesn't give me a good n equal 1 background. I get something like n equal 2 at least.
I don't see a connection to heterotic string except that K3 comes in. But in any case, if I take type 2B on this X, which is not a good vibration, do I understand correctly that you may get an equals 2 supersymmetry?
You may.
That's what you said.
Yes. Also for heterotic. All right. So let me just write these things also more general. So I could have some objects like that, where again the trio of these real two forms sort of enters in a same footing.
So what is little j?
Little j, again, in the case where I am doing here, little j will be the symplectic form on K3.
But now in the new.
So in the new, again, j and omega.
Let me make sure I understand. I is the square root of minus 1.
I is square root of minus 1. Little j is a two form. Just like a real two form, omega is a complex two form. Okay, so on K3, this trio will be the trio of the symplectic forms. Okay.
Can you write just a little bit bigger? It's difficult to see.
I'll try. Okay. So, once you have chosen the form of this, the form of the other guy is more or less given by this condition, all right? Okay. So these are the examples of what these objects look like. Yeah, I mean, I just wrote sort of every case which I knew, but just bear this one in mind, and this is quite close.
The general form of an SU3 times SU3 structure?
I'm saying that yes, the corresponding objects can be always chosen in this form. Actually, there is a general claim that these objects, I am avoiding to give them a name yet, can be always chosen in the form of sums of in this type, where this is some kind of holomorphic K form, and this is just an exponentiated complex form, two form. So, and this K is called a type, and this type is essentially classifying the so-called pure spinner. Okay, I didn't want to use the name until now, and I would want to use the name, and for that I have to do just another step, okay?
Actually, sorry to interrupt. So in that case, do I understand correctly that V and W were one form, so two forms?
In this, again, this is two?
Right.
Yes, so think about it is just dx1, dx2, the coordinates on the torus.
And then connection of the vibration doesn't enter anywhere?
Well, of course it will if you have something more complicated.
Well, we had two examples, a trivial vibration.
No. It works. It works also for the non-trivial one. I just
without inserting any connection.
Of course, with the connection. No. I mean, they do work also with the connection. I can show you the formula afterwards. It's not a very complicated thing.
In the general case, when you write SU3 cross SU3, it seems like no connection.
I am not assuming, you see, this doesn't mean there isn't any kind of fibered metric or anything. In particular, the coordinates, let's say I have morally some, you see, I morally would have some 4 plus 2 split, right?
So it's only...
But everything depends on all coordinates. So I would have a priori full dependence on also two-dimensional coordinates. So this works beyond the vibrations.
So it's only a local statement. So
this is a local statement.
This doesn't exist at all.
Yeah. Well, they might have zeros.
Okay.
So all I'm assuming is that they have isolated zeros, not more than that. Okay? So I will do another rewriting of these equations, which will be sort of a little shorter. Okay? So I'm not very happy with this object phi, which I couldn't even name. So instead, I will define objects psi plus and psi minus, which will be and the way I'm taking the norm is with respect to this Mukai pairing. I can, let me write it. I have 6, I can just write 6. Okay? So, you see, I mean, I have done this simply in some ways, you could think, to make these equations look shorter. Okay? So in terms of these new variables, I have equations which are sort of maximally short.
Linear combinations of
psi 1 and psi 2, well, yeah, I mean, again, psi 1 will be plus for type 2a and minus for type 2b. And
is there a typo in psi minus? You have a phi plus.
Thank you. So. Some of you might find actually annoying that I am using a star here, simply because it looks like a metric data. But in reality, and on one example I will just explicitly show you, that essentially the star becomes a Dolbeau operator. So when I'm using the integrability of the first guy, the closure of the first pure, the star is fully determined by the knowledge of phi 1 and phi 2. Okay.
Why don't you just get rid of the f, since you could write the f's in terms of the geometry, right?
No, this is the equation. This equation determines f's.
No, but isn't there another form that you could write it simply without? I mean, because you could replace the Romer-Romer fields. Romer-Romer fields depends on the geometry, right?
Well, it depends via this equation.
Right, but it also...
It's the same. I'm just rewriting the same equation.
But he's saying, and I agree with him, that you could just try and define f from this equation.
This is exactly what I will be doing when I start looking for examples. I will start building phis, and then out of phis I will calculate f, and then we'll see whether it makes sense or not.
Right. I mean, then the question will be, what kind of sources are you getting?
Exactly.
Right, so if you write it that way, then the equation will be purely an equation on geometry without the additional input of that.
In a way, maybe, but let me just carry on for the moment, okay? So notice that here I have objects which are totally well-defined. I mean, these are symplectic form, omega, they are well-defined by construction. Here I have done something which is a little funny because I have included B inside. B is a local object. So you might, again, I mean, you can just check that these equations are nothing but this. I haven't done anything other than rewriting them, okay?
Psi plus and psi minus might not be globally defined.
Exactly. So, and that this is the essentially the whole idea, that what I would want these guys to be spinors. And spinor representation is not generally a global representation, right? So, I'll explain it, I guess, in a moment. So now it's time to start talking about generalized geometry and sort of try to mumble a little bit the explanation of this equation. So I have written some equations which look simple enough, and now I will try to understand what they mean, okay? So my first step would be just to take a manifold M, six-dimensional in this case, but generically of even dimension 2D, and I will construct a tangent and cotangent bundles to it, and I consider a map from T plus T star of M into itself. Okay. I will ask this to square to minus 1, and also to be Hermitian with respect to a natural metric, which I can define on this object, which is like this, where the ones are d-dimensional. Okay. So in other words, I have defined an almost complex structure on this object, okay? So having defined almost complex structure, next thing I can do, I can define a projector. Again, this is 2D dimensional object minus ij. And using this projector, I can map anything I want into sort of holomorphic objects in the right sense. So, okay, I will be actually interested in objects which are of the following form. And these objects are plus I eigenbundles of J, and so I will call them LJ. Okay? And generically, again, I have written T plus T star, so A will be a form of a vector plus 1 form. Okay? There are some easy properties of this thing, which I can establish. So if I take a product of A and B, such that both of them are, so A and B now are in the eigenbundle plus I eigenbundle of J, it's easy to see that this would be defined like that, and in turn, I can just use this property to speak in J's. Then I can use this property, and this gives me I square. So I end up with, in other words, it's a null space. Okay, so simple. Another property is, so, that since I'm working in a signature of DD, the dimension of this null space is maximal. Simply because I take any real A and I act by pi, it will be in the space of positive I eigenbundle. So it's maximal dimension of null space which I can have in signature DD. Okay. So together this is called, so this is maximal dimension. So together, this says that this LJ is a maximally isotropic space.
Does the current bracket simplify in this case?
Of course. So now I want to do two things. One is to drop the word almost, meaning to, I mean, oh, there is not much value in almost complex structures. So I want to define what integrability means here. And second, okay, what all this has to do with the things that I was writing. So I would like to write to replace this space by something which is equivalent to it but has a sort of better representation, okay? Now, for as far as integrability goes, we can just try to follow what we know about integrability of ordinary complex structure. And I'm sure all you are hoping that I will not be writing Nienhuis tensors, and I will not. So let's just think for a second. I mean, this projector with the smaller letters I could have defined for ordinary complex structures. So then vectors, project them into their holomorphic parts. And the statement of integrability of complex structure is that when I take a Lie bracket, of two holomorphic vectors, it does stay holomorphic. And actually, if you calculate this, I mean, you will see that real and imaginary parts of this expression both are proportional to the Nienhorst tensor. Okay? So this definition I can just carry on just directly to the space of the DD signature. Okay? So the only question is, what do I replace Lie bracket with? Okay? So I need to replace Lie bracket by something which is defined on T plus T star. How do I do that? For that, I'll recall a definition of the Lie bracket, which is like this. Okay, I mean, the expression might not necessarily look familiar, but morally speaking, it should be clear. Lie bracket of two vectors is a third vector. So when I'm writing something like this and I want to write it in terms of two contractions, this is smaller rank than this. So I would need an exterior derivative somewhere. And this is the exact expression. Okay. So one way of telling what's happening here is to say that Lie bracket is a derived bracket. That you have a nilpotent operator D, and this is uniquely sort of fixes the bracket for you. Okay. So what I will do is I will just take the same operator and just simply apply it to a different space. Okay. And what I will get will be some bracket of A and B, which is called courant. If I work out the expansion, what this courant bracket looks like, so I'm writing something which is written on sums of vectors and forms. So what I have is this. So the first piece is just simply Lie bracket. And you can easily convince yourself there isn't much you can do in such a way to, from sums of vectors and forms, to produce another vector. Okay? On the contrary, at the level of forms, right, using exterior derivative, you can sort of have sequence of contractions and exterior derivations. So what this expression does is fixes the relative coefficients uniquely. Okay? So where I remind you that eta is equal to is this. Okay? So here is my bracket, and generally this bracket has one problem, which it does not satisfy Jacobi. But on the space of plus I eigenbundles of the generalized complex structure, it actually does. So that's the special property that Sergei was asking about. Okay? So what do we want now? We want that, so when do we have a generalized, integrable generalized complex structure is when the J in question is closed under courant. Right? So what we want to do now is find a condition where, again, P bar P of A equals zero. Okay? So, but okay, we worked out what the first part of what we wanted, sort of how to drop the word complex. And now I will find, I will write a necessary, a sufficient condition for this to be the case, which will be very easy to work with and will make contact with the objects that I was dealing with. Again, I mean, you probably get the idea already that sort of these alternating sums of forms, which I have, right, they are somehow should be related to some spin bundle. And And the way this thing works is via Clifford action, right? So if I have elements of T plus T star, they act on phi via wedges and contractions. And I'm not using any metric here, right? So I can write it sort of in some basis. I can easily check, if you want, you can think of this as of gamma matrices, or collection of gamma matrices, be written in terms of these operators, right? And it's not hard to verify that if I write their commutators with wedges, this is zero, and on the contrary, dxm En is delta Mn. So this is the Clifford algebra with respect to the metric which I have written here. Okay. So what I am interested is in some Clifford, the spinorial representation of this algebra. Now let me consider a space of annihilators of an object phi. Okay, so this is just a space V plus Xi, such that, it belongs to T plus T star, and V plus Xi on phi equals zero. Okay, so what can I do? I can just take this relation and try to square it. So in other words, if I do on phi, it's not hard to work it out that this is nothing but minus. In other words, the space of annihilators of the pure of these objects, again, of the spinners, is a null space. And this is for any phi. So one other thing which is missing, right? This guy was of a maximal dimension. So spinners can be of a priori of any dimension. So the claim is this. Let me choose this space to be of maximal dimension, which will be D.
Inside this equation? I don't understand this equation.
I put too many brackets, probably, or not, or too little. So you act by first, and then you act by the second. This is the same as just squaring the object with the minus. So if I choose the space of annihilators of phi, which is already an isotropic space, to be of maximal dimension, such a space I will call pure. Okay? So again, maximal dimension of L phi, this would be called a pure space. And now a question is, if I can find sort of a correspondence between these, okay? Because these are nicer objects to work with. And the correspondence, you see easily that this is up to a multiplication by a complex number. Meaning here, this projection, if I multiply phi by something by a complex function, it's not going to change its space of annihilators. Or in other words, one example is, I have written things like this, and clearly ordinary integrable complex structure should be a special case of generalized integrable complex structure. But we know that manifold being complex does not mean it should admit such an omega. Right? The canonical bundle is not necessarily trivial. So this is the multiplication which is sort of missing in this identification. In other words, what I should be identifying the space of plus I eigenbundles is with the lines of pure spinners rather than with pure spinners. So if the proper canonical bundle, which is in the symplectic case e to the j plays the role of it, of the trivialization. If it can be trivial, if it is trivial, then I will just talk about pure spinners. Normally, I should be talking about lines of pure spinners. Okay. For now, let me just forget this difference, and I assume that I'm working on the right manifolds, which sort of have the trivial canonical bundle. So I will just say the word pure spinner, okay? Okay, so the next thing which I can show is the following, that if I have A and B, which do annihilate L phi, then if I take the current bracket of this and act on phi, I will find the following thing. Acting on d phi. So in other words, the bracket will be closed, not per or. If f is closed, then the j will be integrable. Okay, so df equals 0 means it is a sufficient condition to impose the integrability of the associated generalized complex structure. So sufficient condition is actually weaker. I mean, it's not very hard to see that sufficient condition would be simply if d phi was in, there existed v and xi for which I could write this. Okay, this would be sufficient. Roughly here I have two gamma matrices, so I would need d phi to be not more than one creator or annihilator away from phi itself, okay? So, but you see, this is a strong condition and we will live with it. And this is the condition which Hitchin called generalized Calabi-Yau. Okay, yes?
Does that imply that you have, that the warp factor is one?
No, not at all.
There is a more complicated connection.
Yeah, of course.
I see, okay.
All right, so this condition again, it is called generalized Calabi-Yau condition, but it tells us nothing about the metric. So in that sense, it is different from sort of ordinary Calabi-Yau. In order to start talking about the metric, just as we know from case of sort of ordinary familiar geometry, is that you need typically two objects in order to define a metric, right? Knowledge of symplectic structure or complex structure does not tell us about the metric. So when we have fixed one, and let's say we fix the complex structure and we say that J is 1, 1 in that complex structure, which tells us this, then we can sort of hope to know something about the metric. So something similar is here. We do need two generalized almost complex structures, okay? So necessary condition, okay. As we will see, necessary condition for supersymmetry is only one of them is to be integrable. But we need the second one, and we need it to be compatible, and that was the condition which I erased with three common annihilators of phis, so that we have some knowledge about the metric. Okay. Now, what about the equations, which I also erased? I mean, if you remember in my first sort of draft of these equations, I had d minus h all over, right? And a form...
To know about the metric.
Sorry?
Why do we care about the metric?
Well, I mean, if you want to solve, it's not, again...
But if I want to find the vacuum...
You see, this tells me a necessary condition of having supersymmetry. Typically, I would want also to know fluxes and stuff like that. And if I want to make the second step, I rather sort of be able to do it. In other words, I need the compatible pure second. You know, again, formally you can do some things on Kähler manifolds or complex manifolds alone, but you know, if you want a good life, you rather have Calabi-Yau, right?
In some cases of this generalized geometry, the star is determined in terms of phis of size, as you call them, right?
Right. So the difference between ordinary Calabi-Yaus, Calabi-Yaus has both of the structures are integrable, okay? So I'm relaxing one integrability condition, and then I'm relaxing the word complex or symplectic. I can have some kind of hybrid situation where in local charts, sort of part of the manifold will be complex and another part will be symplectic. See, as you see from sort of this way of writing things.
So you say, again, I just want to know the status of it. So the star is determined by phi and psi only if those two guys satisfy compatibility condition?
Right. You see, by construction they do. Sort of, I didn't input it, I just blindly compute it, and by construction these tensor products do satisfy compatibility, okay? But if I want to sort of, suppose I'm in search of vacua, this would be my prescription. After I have found a closed pure spinner, I would want to find a compatible one to sort of go on, okay? All right, so what about this, the fact that I had D minus H in my equations? Well, it's not a big deal from one point of view, because all I wanted in these formal definitions is that D was nilpotent. So you can easily check that D minus H also squares to zero, okay? Because H is closed and H wedge H is zero. So formally, I can just take everywhere every single piece of formula that I have written and replace these by D minus H's, roughly, and the thing should go through. So there is a modification in the courant which sort of goes under name of twisting. Maybe I'll use a different chalk here. This is the only thing which it does to courant if I replace D by D plus D minus H in the formal definition of it, okay? But this is not what we want to do. I mean, again, it can be done, and this, so instead of talking about generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds, we will talk about twisted generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds. But I would sort of rather try to explain why writing things in this way is a little more than just cosmetical sort of dressing up, okay? And you might already suspect there is a sort of a moral reason for doing it without doing anything further. If you look at it, A is a part which has to do with the transverse four-dimensional metric. So, for example, under dualities, this is not a part which will possibly change, okay? On the contrary, if we consider the sort of nicest duality possible, T-duality, and you see, I'm writing things in terms of T plus T star, you are expecting some kind of exchange symmetry between windings and momenta, you see that the phis have no chance of transforming nicely under T-duality. The objects which should transform nicely are the ones which somehow include the B-field, because under T-duality, B and metric mix, okay? So these guys, and the same goes for dilaton, so these guys have a slightly better chance of being sort of a nicer objects than the naively sort of naive ones which appear, which even though the latter are globally defined, okay? So, coming back to the courant, there are two well-known things about it that, okay, I mean, Lie bracket, everyone knows, it has an automorphism, which are the diffeomorphisms, right? So one big thing about courant is that by passing from Lie to courant, we have gained a second automorphism, which is you see here, that if H is closed, then there is some dressing up with B, which will be an automorphism of courant, okay? So the operation in question is what is called B transform. So B transform acts in the following way. It cannot do anything to the vector, but the form can get shifted by the following one form, which is obtained by contraction of B and Xi, okay? So, and then the automorphism of courant is the following, that e to the b, b plus Xi, e to the b, w plus eta, if b is closed, or if it isn't, okay. Good. But just purely formally, you see, at this point, one of the ideas of the formal is to maximally mix the metric and the B field. And what I want to say is just passing to T plus T star is not enough. You shouldn't stop there. So rather than doing that, let us consider an extension. So something which is called generalized tangent bundle. So let us consider the following extension of T by T star. So the idea is to take T and fiber T star over it, okay? And the way I will do it exactly via this V transform, B transform. So the sections of T plus T star are global objects. These are the forms and vectors. E is obviously a local object. So what I do is, I mean, if I choose a chart on U and whatever, say the right words. So when I take a section of T plus T star and restrict it to a local patch, I can identify it with sections of E in the following way, right? E alpha plus, so these are, I am using the same letter, but on the right-hand side, all my quantities are local, right? B alpha. B, of course, is non-trivial. So on the double overlaps, I should have B alpha equals B beta minus D lambda alpha beta, where lambda is a one form which is defined on double overlaps, and it's called connective structure, which on the triple overlaps should satisfy the right co-cycle conditions. So I don't want to write them now, okay? And just as before, we can try to define now spinners on this object, okay? Let me just keep this part and simply write in this corner. Okay, so one way of defining a spin bundle would be the following, again, by its gluing conditions, to say that U alpha, this guy should transform in an exponentiated way. So beta. So this is the correct transformation on the spinners, and this is one of the reasons why I didn't like my sort of global objects. From other side, just why don't we plug in this relation into this expression? I mean, here we are on a double overlap, right? So then you see that on U alpha, what you find is, so I do have some kind of global object which I can construct out of my spin bundle, okay? But it is not the spinner itself. So this is the reason why I am taking the objects in terms of which the equations were written, right, were the phis and they were global. So hence, out of my spinners, I multiply them by e to the minus b in order to make them global, okay? Then comes the question also, why do I need the dilaton, or what does this guy do? Well, to answer that one, we just simply consider the tensor products and the GLD transformations of it. And if you consider the GLD transformations, you will see that they transform mostly as they should, except there is a piece which corresponds to multiplying by a square root of a determinant of a transformation. Okay. From other side, ODD spinners are never abstracted. So this piece cannot come from some kind of non-trivial object. So in practice, what we are constructing is just a product of spin bundle with a trivial line bundle. And the powers of it are such, I mean, we know that, this is a definition again, that this guy is invariant under T-duality. Sort of, if you input that and input the compatibility with exterior derivative, you see that in order to get the right transformation of the objects which appear under in the supersymmetry equations, we also need to include e to the psi. Okay, so and okay, happily, luckily, this is exactly what happens. I mean, what the objects which appear in our equations are. Okay, so to write it briefly, we can write it like this, where these are the spinners, or this is the spin bundle of which is constructed from the generalized tangent bundle, okay. Where I have not just simply added B along with the metric, but actually the things are, or T star is twisted over T using the B. Okay, and the advantages of having things like this object are, I mean, okay, you might doubt it at this point, but there are advantages. For example, if you...
Is E a bundle over M or not?
E is a bundle over M, yes.
It's a well-defined vector bundle over M, which is an extension of Tm by T star.
Right, so in order, I mean, locally it is a product of T plus T star.
E is a twisted bundle over M.
E is a twisted bundle in order to...
Wait, those are different things. A twisted bundle over M would not be a bundle over M.
Ula.
And somehow you're trying to define it using this gerb connection.
That's what I'm doing.
It's actually a twisted bundle over M. But
no, no, I guess,
you wrote,
yeah,
a sequence of bundles. You wrote E as an extension of one bundle by another.
Right.
Which makes it sound like you're writing a bundle over M, a vector bundle over M. Although I don't know what, I'm not sure what notation you really mean.
No, I think it would be rather twisted bundle over M. I think.
That means it's an honest bundle over some other space.
It's an honest
bundle. Not descend to a bundle over M.
Probably not.
Is the bundle the same as a fine bundle? What's the
difference? No, not necessarily.
Well, I think he's trying to do something that's going to live in a twisted K theory, which is,
yes,
bundle over, not over M, but over a space over M.
Yeah. So.
On the other hand, what you wrote is that E is an extension of Tm by T star M. Which but makes it sound like E is a vector bundle over M.
But at that point, B was closed.
No, 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 no. I mean, again, in order to go from E to T plus T star, I need to choose a B, right? These two things are canonically identified by a choice of B.
But you're saying that this actually makes sense when B is not closed.
Absolutely. So instead of closed objects...
More to the point, when H is cohomologically non-trivial.
Right. When instead of ordinary closure, now I should have the twisted closure and all that, okay. So what I gain, for example, is if I have the same space but two different B fields, then I get two different E's. On the contrary, if I have two T dual backgrounds, they will lift to the same E. So in some ways, I mean, writing equations here, it seems like, okay, I'm writing sort of this, the set of all T dual solutions. Now, you might at this point a little bit complain because you would say, okay, I start talking about T-duality and let me assume I have N commuting isometries, that it seems like, okay, from what I'm saying, that some ONN should be an automorphism of Courant. From other side, I was telling you that the automorphisms of Courant are known and this is just diffeomorphisms and B-transforms. So how do I reconcile these two statements? And the answer is that, in order to do it, I have to actually think about what space I am writing my sort of, or the sections of what I am putting in the Courant bracket. So let me just consider something which would be a manifold, which is a torus vibration. Tn, so I call this M, and this is fibered over B, okay? So I can write a set of vectors and one forms which do respect this torus action. So I will write something on the B plus set of functions, and Ks are the generators of the torus, okay? And I can write also similar thing for rows, right, where this would be I, so if this is I, then d theta I will be d star of fi. Okay? So if I write something like this, I mean, essentially I could consider reduction of the current bracket to an object which will be, you know, base plus, well, let me write it like T, the torus, plus T star plus this. And it is on this space where my ONN will be an automorphism. So the simplest thing I can do is, so in particular, it means that an element which I was calling A, which consisted of vectors and forms, now has picked some functions here. So it becomes a quartet. If I write the current bracket, so on A and B, what this guy happens to be, it looks like an ordinary current, which is written on manifold B. And then it has extra pieces, which I can write down, which are G, okay. Well, it will become clear what, so A is this, okay, let me define what B is, right? It will be B, G, lambda, omega. Okay, so if I do this, then I have like this, and here I have D Fi minus, again, so this is a vector, this is a function, this has to be a one form, minus Fi D Gi minus 1/2 D. And finally, there is another function, which is, again, Lie derivative. Minus so here is what I would write on such an object. Now, this is, well, it might not be totally immediately obvious, but it's also, you can see some symmetry here. And it's really not hard to verify that if I take a pair of phi and f, and I send them to phi and f, and I do the same exactly with the other pair of g and omega, that this will be an automorphism of courant, provided A, B, C, D fit the relation so that the matrix is O, N, N. Okay? So yes, I mean, if I just write it on something as simple, then I'll have an ONN, okay? But let me, okay, the whole idea was to do something more complicated, do some kind of B transform, right? So let me do a general B transform here. And so what I will use in this B transform, I will use the three following objects. I will use a two form, and then I will use a pair of one forms. So call them ui and bi. Okay? So just think of the most general transform, sort of inspired by this, you could possibly write. Okay? And while you are thinking, I'll be writing. So I'll write contraction with V by U. Okay, I'm skipping the indices, but you see they are up, so this is all preserved. So the row I could just shift by the ordinary B transform, right? But I can do more. So I can have bi phi I plus phi I ui. And finally, I have the last piece, which is the the scalar here, and that I can also shift by b, right? Again, these are indices down. Now, if I wrote this in the matrix form, you would see that what I have done is essentially I have constructed a lower triangular matrix. In other words, the U is like a connection which sits in this vibration, and B is like a B field with one leg along the fibers, and B2 is the B on the base. And I have avoided writing B with two legs along the fiber. Okay? So in other words, in this sort of new B transform, I do not only ordinary B transform, but also a twisting of the torus over the base manifold. Okay? So if I do such a B transform, then I have to add another line to the to this bracket, and the other line comes in this form. Because I don't want to get into trouble. I'll just talk about it in a second. Okay. All right. So what I have here, I start getting objects like this, dvfi minus gi. Where H2 is dB. So this has an index I, right? So H2I is dB I. Okay? And here I should add an H3. So, and then when you look at this again, everything which was before was an ONN, had an ONN symmetry. If you look at the last line, you see it also has an ONN symmetry, which sends, and let me just write it correctly, yeah, F and H to the same A, B, C, D, F and H. Okay? So that indeed, the ordinary ONN is an automorphism of Courant, provided I write it in the right place. Now I can do two things at this point. One is indeed, as Catherine asked, why don't I write B with two legs? The problem with doing that is that if I did that, then the t-duality and ONN transformation will not be preserving the lower diagonal form of the metric. So I will start having sort of, I start with something like this, and I start having things which start living here. So it is not such a big deal. So if the base manifold is simply connected, in other words, that the all functions are single valued on it, then this B field is just a nuisance. You just use it to sort of redefine the curvature, the connections which will be exchanged under t-duality. If the base manifold B is not simply connected, then you start getting into these non-geometric situations. So whenever you have an object which is not of lower triangular form, then the sort of the identifications that you need to do are the so-called via beta transform. So you would start to want to do things via beta transform, which can be defined like this. Now you psi contract with beta to get a vector, right, plus psi. So there is nothing wrong with such a transformation, but there is nothing wrong provided, you know, you do it on one single patch. So once you start sort of trying to glue such a thing, so here I had all these stories with the connective structures and triple overlaps. I knew I could make sense of the B field, right? I didn't have to assume any sort of topological triviality. While here, the only case in which I could make sense of this transform is when beta is a global object. Okay? When beta is not, then we don't really know what to do. So in other words, I mean, what happens in these cases is that t-duality on E, I mean, on E, everything is automorphism. So E doesn't change. These are just diffeomorphisms of this space E. But after we have done this diffeomorphism, rotation, whatever you call it, we would like to project down to some T plus T star. So two T-dual backgrounds, they have the same E, but they have different projections, different choices of B and the metric. So this the moment when I need to use beta transform in order to project down to T plus T star, it doesn't make sense globally. Okay, so this is what, or at least it's one of the cases where people talk about non-geometric backgrounds. And I will finish by just one more comment, is that, okay, once you look at all this story, you get a sense in which there is possibly another generalization of duality, which is the following. I mean, if I considered this T-duality or ODD transformation, not just on the sections of the torus, but the full thing, what I'm actually writing here is an action of, you know, 1a, 0b, 0c, 1d on vf rho phi. So in other words, this ONN is somehow trivially embedded in ODD, okay? And it is constant. So normally, I mean, if you look at all derivations of ODD, you might ask a question, or you might ask a question why people didn't ask the question before. What happens if I take the parameters of ODD to be coordinate dependent, base dependent, so that they don't violate the isometries? Okay? And the answer is it will no longer be isometry. That's clear, but there is not clear how to handle it. So here, the formalism gives you a possibility that once you make the A, B, C, D's coordinate dependent, you know there is an action of the vectors on them, which means vectors are derivatives. So you will get third, fourth line, which will be sort of violating this ODD automorphism. On the contrary, you might wonder that you could start filling other parts of this transformation. In other words, when you have a local global symmetry and you make it local, you know you have to add a connection. In such a way, to sort of compensate for the failure of automorphism, and eventually it seems like you can get through with it, and there is some bigger symmetry. I mean, how it manifests itself at the level of string backgrounds is that we are used that t-duality exchanges things of different topology. But typically the change of topology comes from the B-field. If we have a non-trivial B-field and the trivial circle, let's say, t-dual background will have a zero B-field and non-trivially fibered circle. So by adding sort of these pieces or doing this kind of a little bigger transformation, what we seem to be achieving is relating twisted and untwisted backgrounds without any use of the B field. Okay? And that seems to be sort of compatible with the supersymmetry equations and everything. Well, and I guess I should stop.